अर्जुनस्यादौ कुर्वन् गीतामृतं ददौ लोकत्रयोपकाराय तस्मै कृष्णात्मने नमः। हरे कृष्ण। सो वेलकम बैक टू अवर भक्ति शास्त्री कोर्स ऑन द भगवद गीता। वी आर कंटिन्यूइंग विद द सेकंड चैप्टर एंड वी डिस्कस टिल वर्स 2.12 and natvevaham jatunasam was also discussed. We'll start with 2.13. So the Bhagavad Gita second chapter, which is called by Srila Prabhupada as contents of the Gita summarized, is basically a call by Krishna to Arjuna to fight. So in the first section, Arjuna's fifth reason and eventual refusal to surrender is talked about from 2.1 to 10. And then from 2.11 onwards, Krishna starts speaking. So 2.11 onwards to 2.30 is Sankhya. The soul is indestructible, therefore fight. This is a counter to Arjuna's objection that if I fight, then my relatives will be killed. And I do not want them to die. So Krishna tells, don't live in the ignorant bodily conception. Rise to the enlightened spiritual conception and know that the performance of dharma never causes harm to anyone. It brings ultimate good to everyone. And for bringing out that ultimate good, if it involves some surgical cleansing, then that is what needs to be done. So that vision of what actually dharma is based on atma gyan is talked about in this section. So we discuss 2.12 refutes impersonalism. It establishes the eternality of the individuality of the soul. And now 2.13, let us start from there. So we have Dehi Nosmin Yatha Dehi Kaumaram Yavanam Jara Tha Dehantara Praptir Dhirastatrana Muhiyati. So Dehi no, inside this Deha, Asmin, there is. Yatha Dehe. So Dehi no Asmin Yatha Dehe. Just as inside the body, there is the owner of the body. And what is the nature of that owner? That although the body changes, the owner remains unchanging. Kaumaram Yavanam Jara. So boyhood, youth and old age, these are the stages through which the body will go. But the Dehi, the person who is situated inside the body, will remain unchanging. And similarly, Tha Dehantara Praptir. Similarly, when the person dies, at that time, the person will get another body. Dhiras Tatrana Muhiyati. A wise person, Na Muhiyati, is not bewildered. Now Srila Prabhupada translates dhiras as sober person. So the word sober is often used in the context of alcohol. A sober person is a person who is not affected by alcohol, who is not addicted to alcohol, or that person has given up the addiction to alcohol. That is a sober person. So dhiras tatra na muhiyati. So the bodily conception is like an intoxication, and becoming free from that intoxication is an important goal of life, and that goal of life is promoted by the practice of devotional service. So, that is what is being talked about over here, that we should practice devotional service, and then by that we will become freed from the bodily conception. Of course, when you are saying here, the Bhagavad Gita doesn't give all of its message at once. It will build the message gradually. So here, devotional service is not immediately mentioned, but it is mentioned indirectly that one should become a dhira. When it says that such things will not trouble an intelligent person. The indirect meaning is, if somebody is being troubled by this, that means that person needs to become intelligent, and then the trouble will not be there anymore. Similarly, Krishna is giving instruction here indirectly by demonstrating an example. Okay, this is how people work. This is how people act. And if we act in this way, then we will not be bewildered. Dhirastatra namuhiyati. So now, what is the point being made over here? We all, when we see a relative or a friend after a long time, especially if a child we see after a long time, hey, you've grown up so much. You're so small, I could pick you up on my palm, but now you won't fit in my lap also. Some relatives may say if they meet a child after 10 years or something like that. So what has happened? So you were like that and you are like this. That's what we say. So you were so small, you will become so big now. So what has happened? That means there is an unchanging dimension to that person that is addressed by our you. And there is a changing dimension which is addressed by you were like this and are like this. So that means all of us have an unchanging dimension, unchanging aspect, unchanging feature to our being, and we have a changing feature. So what is this changing and unchanging? Generally speaking, when we remember a dark complexion person may do some plastic surgery or something like that, or may become fair, or a fat person may do bariatric surgery and become thin. A small-nosed person may do a big nose with surgery and become big-nosed, whatever. Different people can do different things like this. But no matter what they do, still they remain the same person. So now certainly something has changed, something is the same. This is under somebody will say, no, actually I have changed completely. I'm not the same person. But then, even if somebody says, I am not the same person, the reference to I is the same. So there is somebody who is the same. So for example, if I say that, okay, I am living now, and I have not changed. So the child who was there, now I am a young person, middle-aged person. So, I was a child earlier. So, whatever it is it this person the same or different? Somebody said, no, it's different. His child is gone and I am the same. Most of us won't say like that. Now, we can see that there is definitely change at a biological level. Even science acknowledges that. There are different frames of reference that we can take to look at the change at the body level. Now, if we look at the level of organs, although my heart seems to be the same, my arms seem to be the same, but the cells that make the heart and beyond, or the cells that make the arm, they keep changing. So, if a thing is nothing more than its components, then the essential point is that if all the components are changed, is the thing the same or is the thing different? So, we would say that the thing has changed and the thing is still the same. So sometimes, if we have a laptop and then we change the motherboard, we change the hard disk, we change the touchpad, we change the keyboard. Of course, most people will not do such overhauling. They'll say, better take a new laptop only. But when we change small parts like that, and then we'll say, oh, this laptop is now as good as new because the hard disk is new, or because the RAM has been extended, or whatever. So at such times, what are we actually saying? Now, there is something that is old that is continuing, but there is something that is new. On the other hand, if I just leave an old laptop and take a new laptop, then it's an entirely new laptop that is there. So in the first case, there is a gradual change. That means, yes, if I have a laptop, first I change the maybe I change the touchpad, then I change the motherboard, then I change the hard disk, then I may change the monitor. So there are progressive changes over there. But they are one at a time. But if I just take a new laptop, that's a rapid change. So Krishna is talking similarly about two kinds of reincarnation over here. The word inkar, karna, is related with flesh, like sexual or especially lusty pleasure, lusty indulgences, they call as carnal indulgences. So, or it's also called carnivorous, that is flesh eating. So, incarnation literally means to come in flesh. Reincarnation means to come again in flesh. So, reincarnation means that to again get a material body. So, reincarnation, generally we use that word in the sense of when the person dies and then comes back in another body. That is what we refer to generally as reincarnation. But if we consider that the fact that the body is constantly changing, then we can also equally say that there is internal reincarnation in the sense that the body is gradually changing, just like the parts of a computer maybe change one at a time. Similarly, there can be internal reincarnation that can also happen. So that is the difference between internal and external. What is the difference? One is gradual, subtle, and often nearly invisible. It's happening slowly. And the other is sudden, drastic, and visible. Okay, the person was here, the person is gone there. So Krishna is saying, hey, don't get so worked up by the change. That yes, whatever change is happening within this life, that same change will happen in the next life. So, if a child grows up, or if an adult becomes a senior citizen, all that it means is there is a change, but there is something that is continuous also. So, the continuity that persists despite the change, what causes that continuity? Now, in the case of a computer, I was using a different computer, now I am using a different computer, say. So then the case, I, the user, am the same. Now, similarly, if I am going to use a computer which has got certain parts changed, then some part of the computer is same, some part of the computer is changed, but the user is still the same. So same way with the body, whether the body is changed partially, subtly, or completely and rapidly, it doesn't make much difference. The fact is the user remains the same. So Dehi is the person who is occupying the body. So naturally the previous verse was that none of these kings will die. Nor will you die. Never was there a time when these kings didn't exist. I did not exist. You did not exist. All of us are going to exist in the future also. So this immediately raises the question, how is that possible? Actually, either some of those kings are definitely going to die on the battlefield. So how can everybody stay alive? So Krishna is answering that, yes, there is something within the body that will stay alive. The bodies will change, and don't get so worked up by the changes, because such changes are seen everywhere, even in this life. So just as we don't get unduly worked up by the changes from Kaumara to Yavana and Yavana to Jara, similarly, don't get too worked up about the change from Jara to the next body. Ta dehantara praptir. So after mentioning in the previous verse that there is a individual, and all of us are individuals eternally, he's explaining what does all of us refer to. He said it refers to the Dehi. Then now Arjuna gets a question over here. Yes, that's fine, even if I accept this. But still, you know, I'm concerned. I'm concerned that my relatives, they will no longer be there with me. They will die. And I will be the cause of their death. So what will happen after that? So then he says that, yes, what will happen is that you will have to learn tolerance. That is the next verse.
Matra sparshastu kaunteya shitoshna sukha dukkha daha agama paino nityas tamstitikshasva bharata.
So matra sparshastu kaunteya.
So matra sparsha,
the contact of the senses with the sense objects. Tu kaunteya. So again,
Krishna is referring to Arjuna by forms of address which are connected with his body, Kaunteya and Bharata. So it's paradoxical that just in the previous three verses, repeatedly the bodily conception has been condemned. So first was, Arjuna, you're speaking learned words, but you're actually, your emotions are showing that you're uneducated. Then the next verse says that we are all eternal. And this 13th verse said that there is something within the body, the he, that is eternal. And that will occupy another body. So then why is it that Krishna is referring to Arjuna by names which are connected with the body? Kaunteya, Bharata. So Kaunteya refers to him as the son of Kunti. Bharata refers to the descendant of the Bharata dynasty. So of course there are multiple levels of understanding at this. You could, at a spiritual level, you can see Kunti is a great devotee. Bharata, that dynasty, there were great devotees in the past also, and because of that, those dynasties are illustrious. And somebody's monster dynasty, then that, you know, in that identification with the dynasty doesn't have to be material. It can be spiritual, because one is remembering the dynasty for the sake of remembering Krishna, and the remembrance of the dynasty increases one's remembrance of Krishna. So that is one way of looking at it. And whenever there are names which are connected with great devotees, then that is the one way we can look at it. But there will be other places where, like in the next verse, 2.15, we'll have Yamhi Navyathayantete Purusham Purusharshabha. So Purusham Purusharshabha, best among the Purushas. So Dehabhritamvara. Similarly, later on in the Bhagavad Gita, we will have Deha Vritamvara, that one who is the best among those who have acquired bodies. So we may say, this is complete bodily conception, isn't it? No. Again, the point is that any way that a person's spiritual inspiration can be initiated and sustained, that is good for that person. So by the practice of respectful honorifics being used, people are inspired to act honorably. And by thus being inspired to act honorably, they rise upwards. They move upwards in their spiritual life. So the point is to elevate people. The point is to enable people to move onwards in their spiritual life and to act dharmically. So Kaunteya and Bharata are used to make, oh, you belong to the illustrious dynasties, you must act honorably. So we discussed in our Ishopanishad course how we should not pinch the false ego nor inflate the false ego. We should pat the false ego along. Yes, you belong to a great family, then act greatly, you know. Act in a great way. So Matra Sparsha. What is this Matra Sparsha? Sparsha is contact. Matra is the sense objects, material things, which comprise the sense objects. So Matra Sparsha refers to the contact with the material senses. So in the sense objects, contact with the material senses, at that time, there can be various dualities. There can be sheet ushna, there can be sukha dukkha, happiness and distress, heat and cold. Now one understands that this is agama payino anityas. There is a beginning, there is an end, and therefore this is temporary. And because of that, one should tolerate it. Tams titikshas bharata. So in some cases, there are some leeches or some blood-sucking animals. So if they come to suck the blood, so at that time, actually, they just get such a deadly grip on the skin that if you try to pull them apart, they'll hold on to the skin and they'll die holding on to the skin. And if you try to pull them out, actually, they will rip the whole skin out with it. So, otherwise, actually, they have some small tubules which they want to fill with blood. That is their filling, basically. So, if we let those tubules get filled, then after that, they themselves let go and just gently tap it, also they'll fall away. Before that, you have to bring them out, you have to rip apart. So like that. Now, of course, that doesn't mean that if leeches are biting us, we just have to passively watch on. We have to know according to time and circumstance. Some leeches may be removable. Some leeches may entirely be eradicable. We have some kind of protection, then the leeches won't come only. But if sometimes there are these kind of situations where we just can't change anything, then we find that, okay, just be patient. Just be patient. Person is patient, things will go away. So Krishna is telling, agam apayino anityas. There's a beginning, there is an end, there is temporary. But sometimes it just becomes too hot. Or sometimes it rains too much. What does one do at such a time? Okay, some people will just throw a fit over it, become irritable, become frustrated, become irritated. What do you gain by that? Not really much. Better? Tolerate it. The rains will go away. Now, tolerance. Sometimes people think that tolerance is a sign of impotence. You're so tolerant. You're not doing anything. This is so important. If somebody is doing something wrong, why are you so tolerant? Why are you intolerant? Now, of course, in today's language, today's idiom is the way today language is used. As devotees, we use the word tolerance in quite a different way from the way it is used in the media. In the media and today's culture, the word tolerance is used with respect to religious tolerance. But here the Bhagavata is talking about a different kind of tolerance. The idea of tolerance is, as we use it in today's idiom, is, we should tolerate other people's views. So, okay, they have different beliefs. Okay, everybody has a right to have their own beliefs. As they have their own beliefs, so accordingly they will act. So let them act according to their way. And we should not interfere with anybody's right to practice religion of whatever nature they want. That is the idea of tolerance. And this idea of tolerance is important. At the same time, that idea of tolerance, where we talk about different people's right to believe. So similarly, what about tolerance in a more different sense, where our right to put things first is concerned? Now, who takes away that right from us? That is we ourselves. What am I meaning by all this? See, when we are talking about tolerance over here, the Bhagavad Gita, the idea is not that we become impotent. The idea of tolerance is that we allow things to happen in whatever way they are happening, but we keep our priorities fixed. So the biggest battle in life is to keep the biggest battle. That means all of us decide, this is important for me. And then we want to put time, we want to put energy, we want to put heart in doing those things, in doing that particular thing. But then, when we start doing it, another thing comes up, and then we get distracted, and not able to do anything at all. So the biggest battle in life is to keep the biggest battle. So tolerance enables us to keep first things first. Now, if I'm going for a car to office and somebody just cuts me along the road, I get so irritated. I start ranting at that person. And my mood gets spoiled. And then after that, I reach the office and I have some meeting. And I am just so irritated with myself that I just can't do anything properly. So I can't present as effectively as I could have. So what happens is, the ability to insulate ourselves from our surroundings enables us to stay protected and to stay focused, and that's what is required. So tolerance, Krishna says, yes, at the material level things do change. So Krishna is giving two examples to illustrate the example of the change we just talked about in the previous verse. So he says, heat and cold, happiness and distress, these come and go. Similarly, old age, disease, childhood, youth, sorry, not disease here, youth, childhood, old age, these come and they go. And similarly, what is going to happen is other things are also going to come and go. So when these things come and go, we don't have to get unduly carried away by them. Just stay focused. Naam Siddhiksha Swabharata. So, tolerance is not importance, but vigilance. Vigilance means vigilance to keep our energies focused. This is what I'm going to do. And these are other things which I'm not going to do. So we shouldn't think of tolerance as weakness. Tolerance doesn't mean that we let others step on us and others let others use as a wet rag. And you think, oh, I have to be tolerant, I have to be tolerant. Yes, but what is tolerance for? Ultimately, all of life is meant for gaining spiritual realization, making spiritual advancement. And how will we do that unless we are focused? So tolerance is not importance, but it is vigilance. Vigilance by which you can focus on the things that are important for us. Now, Krishna tells Arjuna, yes, you tolerate. Understand that things will be temporary, so tolerate it. And then Krishna takes the vision further, deeper, and he says that actually there are two natures. So before he says that, we'll talk about what will the fruit of tolerance. Yam hi navyathayanti te purushum purusharshamha samadukh sukhum dhiram somritatvaya kalpate. Yam hi navyathayanti te. So one who is not bewildered by such things. Navyathayantya. So one who is not bewildered. Purusham purusharshamha. That Purusha, who is the best of all Purushas. So what about such a person? Samadukha sukham dhiram. Such a person who is safe amongst happiness and distress. Such a person is sa amrutvaya kalpate. A person will attain eternal existence. Sa amrutvaya kalpate. So here, the fruit is talked about of practicing spiritual life. Centered on tolerance. How does this work out? It's just a matter of knowing what to put first. For example, if I'm going on a road, and if I had decided, if I know this is the road along which I have to go, and then I find another detour over here, which is actually not just a detour, it may well be a U-turn, and I end up going where I was originally. So, if I see going along this way and I find, oh, this road is dirty, this road is messy, this road is bumpy. And I look around, this road so cozy. This road looks so comfortable, so smooth. Then I feel, oh, let me take this road. So we decide roads, which road to take, not based on appearances, but based on destinations. It's not that suppose somebody is going from, okay, where are you going? Whichever road looks good, I'll go there. No, we don't do like that, do we? If the road is good, that's a bonus. But where we go is not decided by how the road looks. Where we go is decided by where the road takes us. Similarly, we can't decide our life's priorities by first looks, by appearances. So Krishna said, yes. Now these appearances are not just the way people appear, look, the way people dress, or the way people, people's hairstyle is, or whatever. Krishna is talking here about something much deeper. The way things feel to us at first may not necessarily be the best indicators of what they actually are. So Krishna is telling that, don't be distracted by these temporary changes of the world, whether it is be happiness and distress, whether it is sukha, so things like that, happiness and distress, sukha, samadukha sukham dhira, whatever causes, just tolerate it, it will go away. Yam hi navyathayante te, one who is not bewildered, purusham purusharshabha, that person, or most of the persons, what happens to such a person? Samadukha sukham dhiram. After staying equipoised amongst happiness and distress, somritatvaya kalpate. Somritatvaya kalpate. Such a person will attain eternal existence. So, 2.415 talks about the fruit of liberation. It talks about how by tolerance one will achieve liberation. Yam hi navyatyante te purusham purusharshabha samadukha sukham dhiram somrutatvaya kalpate. So amrutatvaya, that by this we will attain amrutatva, by it will attain eternal life. So after describing this, that when we don't let ourselves get distracted by the small things of life, we are able to focus on the big things in life. By describing this, now Krishna moves forward to describe that actually there are two natures. What is this amrutatvaya? What is this eternity that we will attain? Where is it situated? That he describes in the next verse. So, na sato vidyate bhavo, na bhavo vidyate sataha, ubhayor api drishtontas tvanayos tattva darshibhi. So, na asato, that vidyate bhavo, asata, here, this is quite a poetic use of words, where we have asata and bhava being repeated. Na asato vidyate bhavo. So sata and bhava is there, and then bhava and sata, their positions are interchanged. So na abhavo vidyate sataha. So these are varieties of literary devices, they are called, or figures of speech, which are used as ornaments to make speech more beautiful, more appealing, more aesthetically sweet. So na sato vidyate bhavo, na bhavo vidyate sataha. So when we say that Bhagavad Gita is a poem, so it's a Gita. Gita means it's a song. So it is sung, it was sung by Krishna, and actually it was arranged at the time when the Mahabharata war was about to take place, that now Sanskrit was the ordinary conversational mode that was there. That's normal. Now in the Rig Veda, if you see, in the Upanishads, there are many passages that are not so much meant for recitation. Of course, we can find a tune to recite them, but they are more in the form of text. There are two kinds of writing. There is text and there is poetry. So Gadya and Padya also it is called in Sanskrit. So like that, text and prose and poetry is there. So now prose can also have some poetic qualities, some rhyming words. But poetry is more, it's more esoteric. The poetry often has levels of meaning. And writing poetry is art. So in the scriptures, there is prose and there is poetry also. So the Bhagavad Gita is poetry. Poetry in the sense that it is a poem that has been recited by the Supreme Lord. It's a philosophical poem. A philosophical poem means it's a poem that deals with philosophy, that explains how the theistic devotional philosophy is the topmost of all philosophies. And while describing this, it also describes that we are all meant to not just understand and assimilate it, but also recite it. Reciting is not only purifying, this definitely it is purifying, but it's also aesthetically, musically, very enriching, fulfilling, pleasing. So this is, now within a poetry also, what makes the poetry beautiful is the rhyming of the use of rhyming words, the use of different figures of speech. So here there is a figure of speech where na asato vidyate bhavo, na bhavo vidyate sataha. So there is an inversion of the normal way of speak of the, in the second text there is an inversion of the way the statement is made in the first text, and in this way there is a musical effect that is created also. So for example, in English, we may have, you can take a devotee out of Vrindavan, but you cannot take Vrindavan out of a devotee. So this is an example of a play of words where the more or less structure of the sentence is the same, but what comes second is made first, and what comes first is made second. You can take a devotee out of Vrindavan, but you cannot take Vrindavan out of a devotee. So Vrindavan and devotee interchange positions, and by that, the second part of the sentence, while contrasting the first, also emphasizes the first. And overall meaning becomes more impactful. Or like, ask not what your nation has done for you, ask what you have done for your nation. So these are figures of speech which help to ornament the text. So nasato vidyate bhavo na bhavo vidyate sataha ubhayor api drishtontas tvanayos tattva darshibhi. Now when we talk about Krishna is telling over here, ubhayor vidyate ubhayor api drishtontas. So there are ubhayas two. There are drishta antas. Now first we have drishti. But when we take our drishti deep, when we become more philosophical in our vision, and when the drishti goes to the anta, it goes to the conclusion. Like we have Veda and we have Vedanta. So Vedanta is the conclusion of Veda. Similarly, drishta anta. So drishtontas. So drishtontas means that when our drishti comes to its conclusion, then we understand that essentially there are two natures. There is the material nature and there is the spiritual nature. And what is the characteristic of each of these? So na asato vidyate bhavo. That of the asat. Asat means temporary. Of the temporary, there is na asato vidyate bhavo. There is no existence for a long time. Of the temporary, there is no endurance. And of the eternal, na abhavo vidyate sataha. Sataha is that which is eternal. Of the eternal, there is no cessation. Na asato vidyate bhavo. Of the eternal, na asato vidyate bhavo. Of the temporary, there is no endurance. Of the eternal, there is no cessation. Now when Krishna is talking about this, what is he referring to? He is referring in a generic sense to spiritual and material nature, and specifically he is referring to the soul and the body. So the soul is eternal, the body is temporary. Now asata can mean temporary. Prabhupada uses the translation over here, non-existent. And then he says the material body. So those who are seers of the truth have concluded. So drishta anta, tattva darshibhi, seers of the truth, have concluded drishtanta. That drishtanta, of the non-existent there is no endurance. So, and of the eternal there is no change. Now, non-existent and eternal, Prabhupada puts in these square braces as the material body and the soul. So, in English there are different conventions. When a parenthesis or a circular bracket is put, at that time, it is something which has been put to clarify the meaning further. It's an additional elaboration. Whereas a square bracket indicates that it has been put to just add to what has been said earlier. So these brackets can have sometimes interchangeable purposes. But the square bracket generally indicates that what has been added immediately qualifies what has been said. It's just a clarification of the meaning. Often the square bracket is also used at times when the author has said something, and then, for example, if we have he, if I'm quoting some sentence, he went to Rome but he never came back. That's a quote. Now who that he is? Now because that quote is coming from a particular play, within the context of the play, that who that he is will be very easily clear. Because there will be preceding and succeeding passages which provide context and make and tell what is the antecedent for that pronoun he, who that he is referring to. But when we take it isolation, then what is done at that time is, along with the he, there, now because the quote is out of context and he is not clear over there, so in the square bracket we put, okay, he is, okay, it could be say, whoever, it may be some Roman character, say, whatever, Brutus, Caesar, whoever. So he went to Rome, but he never came back. So now the square braces indicate something which is additional information which makes the point clear. So that is something which is added to make the point clear, whereas the parenthesis, something is put in parenthesis, that is indicated by the author to put something more clear. So the author himself wants to clarify what is being said over there. Of the non-existent, there is no endurance. The eternal, there is no cessation. So Krishna is telling Arjuna that there is this world is non-existent. The body is non-existent. You may say, how is that possible? I can see my hand around me. This exists. So actually, Srila Prabhupada often uses the word non-existent in terms of the word temporary. As for example, Srila Prabhupada once gave a class in which he said, actually, this world is an illusion. And our sense of separate existence apart from Krishna is also an illusion. So you have to go out of this illusion. Now, when he said this, so he, one of his disciples, he went to his room and then he was saying that, he's saying, okay, this wall is here. And this wall is illusion, I'm illusion. Prabhupada did not say I'm illusion, but Prabhupada said actually this world is an illusion. So our current conception of who I am the body, that is an illusion. This wall is an illusion. So if I just meditate, this wall is an illusion and I walk through it, can I walk through it? So this wall is an illusion, this wall is an illusion, this wall is an illusion. And he walked into the wall. Bam! He banged his head. Banged his head, went to Srila Prabhupada and he said, Prabhupada, you said the wall is an illusion, but I wanted to walk through the wall and I got a blow on my head. So Prabhupada said, you have to understand what it means to me, say it's an illusion. It's like a dream. While we are experiencing it, the dream is a reality for us. If a tiger is chasing me in a dream, while the dream is going on, it appears to be real for me. So then when we wake up, we call the dream false because we understand, okay, there's nothing here. All that I was thinking of was, what is it all about? There's no meaning to it. So when we think in this way, then we understand that actually we call the world illusion in the sense that it is temporary. It is there, but afterwards it will not be there. So we have some relationships now, we have some possessions now, we have some hobbies now. So are all of these going to be there forever? No. And now so if they are connected with Krishna, then they have something spiritual with them also. But otherwise, they are connected with the body. And to the extent we get caught up in them, to that extent we suffer, to that extent we perish. And perish not just physically at the destruction of the body, but also we perish emotionally. We suffer and torment ourselves emotionally. When the things that we are attached to, they are taken away from us, a part of us can at one level emotionally choke and die. So getting attached to illusion is unfortunate. Now, if the process of bhakti is such that it tells us the illusion is not the body or the relationships or the inclinations or the world at large. The illusion is our inability to see them in connection with Krishna. Pratyartham yat pratiyete na pratiyete chatmani tam vidyadatmano mayam yathabhaso yathatamaha. So, pratyartham yat pratiyete. What we think of as meaningful, na pratiyet chatmani, but if you don't see its connection with the absolute truth, vidyadatmano mayam, know that to be maya. So essentially the illusion is the inability to see the connection of things with Krishna. When we see the connection of things with Krishna, then we actually move forward and use those things in Krishna's service. So here Arjuna is not able to, or the people in bodily conception in general, are not able to see the connection of things with the absolute truth. And in that sense, things are asata. So they are not illusory, they are not illusion, but they are illusory. In the sense they are temporary, and if you get attached to temporary, don't see the connection of the temporary with the eternal, then we come under illusion. So this they have concluded, so by this studying the natures of both. So at first drishti will just be caught by the world. But when we look at the world, we see so many things are happening. There must be something underlying. some reality beyond this world. That is the spiritual reality. So Krishna is building up a flow of thought over here, and he's saying that there is an eternal reality which all of us need to move towards. And the wise see these two realities, and they move from the temporary to the eternal. Let's move forward. Next verse.
Avinashita tadvidhi yena sarvamidam tatam vinashyam avyayasyasya nakaschit kartum arhati.
Avinashi tu tadvidhi. Know that all that is avinashi. What is that? Yena sarvamidam tatam. That by which everything is pervaded.
Vinasham avyasyasya,
of this which is avyaya, the vinash of that, na kaschit kartum arhati. Nobody can do that. So here, Krishna is talking without giving any clear antecedent. What is it? The sarvam. What does the sarvam refer to? The sarvam is not the antecedent for that. Everything. So what is it everything referring to? Is it referring to all existence? Or is it all referring to the body? So now, Prabhupada explains to us that it refers to the body. The impersonalists say that actually this refers to the soul. It refers to all of existence. And they say this is a statement about supporting impersonalism. This verse basically it means, what does it mean? That which pervades the body, know it to be indestructible. And nobody can destroy that soul. Nobody can destroy that which is avyaya, that which is imperishable. So what is the difference between avinashi and avyaya? Avinashi means indestructible. And avyaya is actually meaning, Prabhupada translates, imperishable. That means that it is not something which degrades due to old age. So there is degradation or deterioration and there is destruction. So avyaya refers to there is no deterioration because of oldness, and avinashi refers to there is no destruction. So this is nakaschit kartum arhati, nothing can destroy. So now, what does sarvam refer to? If we look at what the topic is, Krishna is talking about the body. Dehi nasmin yatha dehi, he has talked about it, and he has told tolerate the changes. And then if you see the next verse, antavantai me deha nityasyokta sharirinaha. The next verse also talks about the body itself. That which is inside the body, know it to be destructible. Know it to be indestructible. So in that sense, if we look properly from the context point of view, we will see that this interpreting the sarvam to refer to everything, all of existence, is an unwarranted interpretation based on the context. From the context, because the whole discussion is about the body, so it is all referring to body and the soul. So that which pervades the entire body, know it to be indestructible. And in that way, one can move forward. That, yes, here Arjuna is saying, Krishna is telling Arjuna that actually the Bhishma, Drona, whom you are concerned the death about, actually, who are they? They are these particles of spirit who are pervading the body, and they are actually indestructible. That soul, which they actually are, is indestructible. Now, the sarvam, because the Mayavadi sometimes interpreted it to mean all of creation, so Ramanujacharya gives another explanation in his Gita commentary. He says that actually, we have to look at the sarvam from the context of what is comes after it. So what comes after it? Vinasham avyasyasya na kaschit kartum arhati. So the point that is being talked about here is that whatever it is that pervades everything else, that is indestructible. So now, what is the connection between pervasion and destruction or indestructibility? So, unless when we talk about that connection, then we don't see the integrated thought that is there in this verse. So the integrated thought that is there in this verse is that yena sarvam idam tatam. Generally, one object destroys another object by pervading into it, by entering into it. For example, the object like, say, bullet. The bullet enters into us and then destroys our physical structure. When a person drowns, what happens? Water enters into the person. When a weapon kills, the weapon enters into the person. So when ants enter into a tree, termites enter into a tree, then from within they enter, they penetrate, pervade, and thereby they destroy. So generally, the object, if one object can be pervaded, penetrated by another, then that's one way to destroy that object. So Krishna is emphasizing that the Atma cannot be pervaded by anyone because it pervades everyone, or rather everything. Nothing can penetrate the Atma, nothing can pervade the Atma, because the Atma penetrates and pervades everything. And because it penetrates and pervades everything, thereby it becomes indestructible. So Krishna says, Arjuna says that I am going to shoot arrows at Bhishma and Bhishma. So okay, you are saying that there is one part is destructible, but what if the arrows hit the soul? No, the arrows cannot hit the soul, because the Atma pervades everything else. The consciousness, and which is the energy of the soul, which pervades, it doesn't destroy. It cannot be destroyed because it pervades everything. It cannot be pervaded by anything. It cannot be penetrated by anything. That's how he explains the sarvam. Now, what is it that pervades? So what is it that pervades? That is the consciousness. So the soul is at one particular place and the soul radiates its energy. How does the soul radiate the energy? Through consciousness. The soul's energy is consciousness. And the consciousness is radiated, spread throughout the body. Now we all know that the sarvam, if it is actually, it doesn't refer to the full existence. My consciousness pervades through my body, but it doesn't pervade through your body. So if you are feeling some back pain right now, I can't feel it, because my consciousness is not pervading your body. Its pervasion is limited to my body. So Prabhupada explains that just as when a medicine is given, the effect of the medicine, it enters into the body through the blood, through the, say if it's oral medicine, it enters through an alimentary canal and then it spreads all over the body. How does it spread? In this case, it spreads through the blood current. So like that, the consciousness in a similar way, it spreads all over the body. Yena sarvamidam tatam. This way it spreads all over the body. And then further, that which pervades all over the body, that is indestructible. So the consciousness and its source, that is the Atma, they are indestructible. They are eternal. Consciousness is eternal, the soul is eternal. And the whole point of this discussion is to drive home to Arjuna, do not lament, because all this is eternal. You do not have to lament. That Krishna will emphasize in the next verse again. So, the next verse is, now Prabhupada quotes several verses here from the Upanishads to talk about how, when you talk about pervasion, so first he says, what is that pervades? Okay, the soul is situated at one particular point, it is of a small size, 1/10,000 the tip of a hair. Bala Grishatta Bhagasya Shraddha Kalpitasya. This is a famous verse, and then it's from Shvetashvatara Upanishad. And then another verse also, which says the same, Kesha Grishatta Bhagasya Hitamsha Sadrushatmana, Sadrushatmakaha. So, anyway, the point is, Bal Agra Shatabhagasya. So, if I take a hair, and then I take its tip, and then I cut it into 10,000 parts. So, Shatabhagasya, 100 and then 100 again. Then that what remains will be the size of the soul. Now, this raises a question. Is this literally to be taken? The soul is 1/10,000 the tip of a hair? If you are going to say it is literal, then the question arises, what exactly is the tip of a hair? You know, I could say that this much is the tip of a hair. I could say this much is the tip of a hair. I could say, how do I decide what exactly is the tip of a hair? So the emphasis over here is that two points are there over here. When the scriptures give such sort of figures over here, is it literal or it is metaphorical? Actually, it is both literal and metaphorical. It's metaphorical, it's symbolic in the sense that it's indicative of how small the soul is. It's extremely small. But at the same time, if we just think, oh, actually there's no, it's just a symbolic thing. It's not symbolic in the sense that the soul actually has dimensions. You know, we shouldn't think just because the soul is a radiating consciousness, so it is formless. The soul has the original Swarupa in the spiritual world. And even now when the soul comes, the soul is in the form of a chitkana, a particle of consciousness. The soul is in the form of a small, tiny being. It's like a seed right now. So either way, the point is that we shouldn't think that the spiritual realm is dimensionless. So dimensions are not the monopoly of the material realm. Dimensions are present even in the spiritual realm. So Krishna has a particular height, Radharani has a particular height. So whatever it is that is there in the spiritual world, it has form. It has, so, and that form means there is a particular height, a particular dimensions to it. So like that, the Atma, we shouldn't think of it as formless. So we can take it literally in the sense that the Atma has dimensions. We can take it metaphorically in the sense that the Atma's dimensions are so small that they are like Keshagarshita Bhagasya Chitadha Kalpitasya Cha. So the emphasis is neither that it is literal or it is metaphorical. The emphasis is to communicate to us the point that the soul is actually not just some amorphous spray of consciousness. It is actually a particle from which consciousness is spreading outwards. Now, Prabhupada explains further that actually the soul is accompanied by the super soul. And Prabhupada quotes the famous several verses here. So here, Prabhupada quotes another verse which says that the soul is atomic in size, Esho Anuratma. So this is one Munda Upanishad. Esho, this is Anuratma. Chetasa Veditavya. So how can it be known? Chetasa, by consciousness, by intelligence, Veditavya. So we can't see it with our gross senses, it's atomic. Again, the point is, it's so small that we can't see it. If somebody says that, oh, it's 1/10,000 the tip of a hair. Okay, if we use a microscope, which has a resolution of more than 1/10,000, then will we be able to see the soul? The important point is to recognize that the soul is spiritual. And that which is spiritual cannot be seen by gross material vision. So our inability to see the soul comes not because of its microscopic nature, but because of its spiritual nature. But when it is present in the world, it is actually in a microscopic form. And that is indicated through the dimensions. So, Chetasa Veditavya, that actually it is known through the Chetasa. Yasmin Prana Panchadatha Samvesha. So actually what is being said is, soul is floating in the five types of airs which are situated within the heart. So, we discussed earlier about how situated is Prana, Apan, Vyan, Saman, Udan. These are the five airs. And each of them has a specific function. So, these functions are in the sense of they bring about different movements within the body. So, we can, it's a different way of looking at the world from our modern medical reductionistic way of looking at the body and at the world. So, it's quite involved in its own way. But the important point here is that we could conceive, if you want to translate those concepts into what the prana, apan, vyan, saman are, if you want to translate them into our understanding, so they are like vectors. So if you see, there's a vector going up, down, left, right. So all these vectors are there. Now depending on their different forces and their directions, if all of them were having a resultant coming at a particular point, then the point at which the resultant is zero. That is the place where, according to Sankhya, the Atma is situated. It's floating within the five airs. Now, when it is floating within the five airs, as we discussed earlier, the airs are the interaction between the one mode of interaction between the gross body and the subtle body. The subtle body itself is the mode of interaction between the gross body and the soul. So in this way, pranaishchitnam sarvam otam prajanam. So Prabhupada here is basically quoting from Mundak Upanishad to substantiate the point of the Bhagavad Gita that yena sarvam idam tatam. So similarly, pranaishchitnam sarvam otam prajanam. So sarvam otam prajanam. It spreads its influence over the body of the embodied living atma. Yasmin vishuddhe vibhavati esha atma. So we can perceive this spiritual nature of the soul when actually we become free from the influences of contaminations. So the purified is the combination of the five kinds of material airs. So here this is analysis which is done in terms of the five airs. So the whole process of prana is to direct our process of pranayam, which is involving the regulation of the life airs, is meant to lift our consciousness upwards towards Krishna, upwards towards spiritual reality. And actually there are various chakras in the body. We'll discuss about this in the 8th chapter. So the whole point is that the Atma, when the yogis practice, they raise it through the various chakras. So that center where the prana, where the resultant is neutral, at that place of the Atma situation, they try to lift that upwards. They bring it to the head, forehead, the Agni Chakra, and then they try to escape from the bodily bondage and return to the spiritual destinations. So Prabhupada mentions also about Hatha Yoga in the purport. The whole point of the discussion is that the Atma which pervades the body is the Atma, but it is not the Paramatma. So Prabhupada says only the insane man can think of the atomic soul. Only the insane man can think of the atomic soul as the all-pervading Vishnu. Now, Prabhupada makes this interesting point. Medical science accepts the importance of red corpuscles, but it cannot ascertain that the source of energy is the soul. Medical science, however, does admit that the heart is the seat of all energies of the body. So now, what does this actually mean? We have to understand that there is this interaction between the gross body and the subtle body, and ultimately between the material part and the spiritual part, this gross and subtle bodies, and the soul. It's quite intricate and complex, because the spiritual itself is difficult to complex for us, it's too difficult to comprehend for us, and even the subtle is difficult to comprehend for us. So the precise understanding of the mechanism may be difficult, but the important point is that there's a sophisticated system of mechanism, so sophisticated system of interaction that exists, and there are various means through which it happens. Now, modern science may say that, okay, when we take food, then that food is the source of energy. Or it may say that actually the brain is the sole seat of consciousness. So everything happens from the brain. Now, all that is true. The body is a complex mechanism, and there are multiple centers of critical importance. So all of them play their role. Yes, we have to eat food. The stomach generates energy. And a wound to the stomach can be fatal. Similarly, the heart also pumps blood. It ensures the circulation takes place. So that is also very important for survival. A heart attack can be fatal. Similarly, the brain is important. The brain is also the seat of consciousness. Brain damage can also be fatal. So the important point in all these discussions is that actually the Atma is eternal. The Atma is eternal and the soul is temporary. And the Atma's consciousness pervades the soul through a mechanism which is quite complex for us to understand. There are multiple levels of interaction, and the Atma is situated in the heart, but its consciousness through the subtle body goes through the mind. So it goes through the subtle body, through the mind to the brain, and from their brain it goes outwards. So the consciousness may be radiating through the body, from the mind. Prabhupada explained that the energy is coming through the blood. So the whole mechanism of interaction is complex. And we'll continue our discussion in the next class. Thank you.
Hare Krishna.